Blog Talk Radio.
Man, I'm so hyped right now. Anything's possible. Anything's possible.
RSD Renegade Radio. Where real guys talk real sports. Allow me to introduce the illustrious three-man booth.
I want winners.
What's your name, boy?
Watch the game changer.
What's your name, boy?
D-Well.
Now, ladies and gentlemen.
T.O.T. Sports PhD.
The world famous.
Ray.
They are who we thought they were.
We need more dollars.
RSG, Renegade Radio. The plug is about to open, about to open. Everybody has an opinion.
A man must have a code.
We're taking RSG to the next level.
Hello? You play to win the game.
You could gripe about Mike's game, but I don't see shooting percentage getting it.
I mean, I'm not griping the third overall player on my list.
Is it safe?
Nah, I blame it on Nintendo. It's provocative. He's real big excuses, you know. We're not going to make any excuses.
You need to move more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. Can't wait. Can you dig it, sucker?
Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports. I am your host and one-third of the illustrious three-man booth. This is Mark the Game Changer. I got the team in the house. You've joined us this evening. You could have been anywhere else in the world, but for the next 2 hours, you've chosen to be here with us, the Real Sports Guys, RSG, Renegade Radio. Now, before we get into the proceedings this evening, I'd like to introduce the other two-thirds of the illustrious three-man booth. To my right, I got my man, D. Wills. Holla at the people.
I'm here. You know, socks are slightly pulled up high. I'm focused, ready to go.
Say, socks just slightly hugging below the kneecap. Slightly below the kneecap.
You know, Lawrence T. Moten style. So, for you Cubs fans out there.
Whatever happened to that cat, man?
You know what, man? I have no clue. I'm sure he probably had a very decorated career overseas because the kid could play. I'm almost positive of that. But, yeah, he didn't stick in the league, man. But, man, Poetry and Moten could ball, couldn't he?
Yes. I love him.
Yeah. So D Wills with the strong check in. To my left, I got my man, Phil T, Sports PhD. What's happening, Captain?
I cannot play with him. Cannot win with him. Cannot coach with him. Can't do it. I want winners. I want winners.
It's the motto around these parts. We want winners. All right, and we're gonna give it to you. We're winners. We want winners. You listen to the Real Sports Guys, RealSportsGuys.com, RSG Renegade Radio. We have a jam-packed show tonight, I must say that. There's a lot to get into, so we got to get into a portion of the show we call the intro to let you know. That's where we run it down real quick, get you our itinerary so that you know where we're going to take you tonight. It's going to be a heck of a ride, so buckle in and hang on as we get into what we do. First up, we have the Funky Editorial. This week's Funky Editorial is going to feature Penn State again. I mean, this is three straight weeks we've been talking Penn State. there's been so much to talk about with this particular story as it's evolved from where it was. It kind of became stagnant. But now there have been some tremendous changes and a very interesting evolution to how things have developed in State College, Pennsylvania. So we're going to get into that. The sanctions came down this week. The NCAA levied some heavy sanctions on Penn State football. So we're going to talk about that, whether it was just or unjust. How do they pick up the pieces of this program? How long does it take them to recover? We're going to get into all that and more when we talk Penn State during the Funky Editorial. Then we're going to have a special section of the show. We're going to talk a little golf, not something that we do often. We don't talk much golf outside of a little Tiger talk on the Real Sports Guys. This week, we're going to talk about the British Open, give you a quick recap, talk about Adam Scott and his inability to finish, also known as a choke. We're going to get into that. And we're also going to give you our five most memorable choke jobs of all time. So you get the RST version of top five choke jobs of all time in sports. Yeah. Then we're going to hit you with the five on the black-hand side. We're going to go over the top five wide receivers in the NFL going into the 2012 season. We've gone through running backs and quarterbacks. Now we're going to hit you with the wide receivers. This week, training camp opens. So we want to keep that going as we go through the preseason. We're going to highlight each position and give you our top five guys at that particular position going into the 2012 season. Then we're going to talk some Olympics. All right, we're going to get into the Olympics, talk a little bit of Olympics, give you a preview of that. We're going to talk about some of the non-traditional, some not quite real sports guys kind of sports that we watch and that we look forward to watching during the summer games. Some of those off-the-beaten-path sports, we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about the MLB. Trade deadline is quickly approaching. Yankees made a big deal, signing Ichiro Suzuki. Ryan Dempster is still on the block. We thought we had a trade yesterday. That trade didn't go through. So we're going to talk some of the trades, some of the big storylines coming up in the second half of the season. So we're going to hit on some of those things. We're going to get into the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Resistance Digital is our sponsor. They sponsor the show. Check out Resistance Digital for all your digital solutions. They sponsor our segment, Dog of the Week, where we nominate somebody who's had their dog meter at 10 for the past week. And we're going to go into the shutdown mode where we shut down the show. And we put a pretty little bow on it. So thank you for joining us. We appreciate your patronage. We have a slamming show for you, and we're going to jump right into it.
Fellas, one thing we need to say.
Yes.
Shall we say it, y'all?
Yes.
Melvin,
right.
Jimmy,
yes.
Coleman,
yes.
Ryan,
yes.
Sit.
Yes.
Everybody want to get funky one more time.
All right, another spoonful of Penn State. Here we go. All right, now I'm gonna set the table, and then you know I'm gonna call a set, and then I'm gonna get my guys in position to score. All right. So sanctions came down from NCAA President Mark Emmert. Penn State will have to pay a $60 million fine. Penn State will not be able to participate in a bowl for 4 years, and I can't remember how many scholarships they're going to lose. Scholarships, their players can transfer without penalty. Coaches can also be let out of their contracts without penalty if they find a job elsewhere. The Big Ten has also levied some sanctions upon Penn State University's football program. Penn State's football program will not be able to participate in the Big Ten Championship for 4 years. So this is pretty unprecedented, pretty heavy-handed on the NCAA's part. You know, I was a proponent of sanctions. I wasn't sure whether or not the NCAA would actually be able to do anything, given the nature of what happened. But it seems as if they were. Now, the first question, I'm gonna pass it to D. Wills, and when D. Wills is done, I want Phil T. to jump in with his comments on the same question. D. Wills, how do you feel about the sanctions?
Yeah, I was and Phil and I talked a little bit offline. We all check in with each other when these things go crazy, and we spoke a little bit about this yesterday, and I was surprised. And part of it is I didn't know if the NCAA would go this far on the sanctions. The money doesn't surprise me. The $60 million doesn't surprise me. So that part doesn't surprise me, but I was surprised at the 4-year ban. It almost feels like, man, you almost would want a 1-year death penalty. The 4-year ban just feels a lot like a slow death, but I can't, because it was so egregious. It's hard to say that the punishment doesn't fit the crime. I mean, I don't know if you can come up with a punishment that would address these issues. So that's my initial thought with it. But I was just surprised that they went this far.
Yeah, my initial thoughts really line up with yours, Devon. I'm just so surprised because, whenever punishment is dealt out, we're always looking for a precedent. He only got this much punishment, so I kind of know what I'm going to get. This is a very unique situation, like you highlighted, Devon. And so I think they hit him in every which way. My question is how does this punish the people that were most guilty? And in many ways, it doesn't. It punishes fans. It punishes players, young men that were no part of the program and no part of the problem. And it's penalizing coaches who, I feel really, I don't know if bad is the right word, but, I kind of feel a certain way about Coach O'Brien, who took this job after all this information came out and Paterno got fired. So in many ways, he knew what he was walking into, or at least he had a general idea and an educated idea and a good guess what he was headed into. And they seem to really be rebounding, especially with the recruiting class. And now the NCAA comes in and the hammer comes down. And, one of the questions I had was, where's the due process here?
Well,
the Freedom
Court
pretty much has replaced the Bible.
What you're talking about, that due process thing, I think is right on point, is that for an organization that takes a long time to make decisions, they bypass all elements of their normal due process, that's what was surprising me. I mean, they didn't do any real investigation. They just took the free report and acted on that, even though that was surprising in terms of what your point about the due process in the way that was the most surprising about how they came out. But Bobby Bowden had a great reaction when asked about the thing that you just raised, Phil. He said, Bobby got real biblical. He's one of my favorite coaches of all time. He said, we pay for the sins of our fathers. He said, it's always been that way in the NCAA. The generations later, the present and the future, always pay for the sins of the past. That's the only way that you can never change that. And I think that's part of what has to be accepted by Penn State.
Yeah, and I hear you on the due process piece. I agree. I think, I think they are. You said it, and you were being tongue in cheek with it, but I think those words ring true, that the free report has somewhat replaced the Bible, and it is being taken as unquestioned truth at this particular point, which makes it real difficult to get behind the NCAA on their sanctions. I understand the need to feel like they had to do something, because I'm one of the people that feel like they had to do something. And that piece of the due process part, I definitely understand and I empathize with Penn State. But I also will say Penn State commissioned the free report, and they're not arguing it. You know, it's a report that they commissioned. And so, again, I think they've given themselves a due process, and the NTA is just simply taking the evidence that they have presented themselves as to what happened and using that to sanction them. And honestly, I think that's an unprecedented amount of autonomy. Usually the NCAA would do an independent investigation and then levy some sort of sanction. So in this situation, they've actually given the school almost like a gift. Okay, we'll just go by yours, and we won't do one of our own, which is what they've done in this particular situation. How I feel about it, I think, you know, I'm a strong proponent that they needed to do something. If you're going to get after kids for all the things that you get after kids for, you have to, this is how I view the situation. In this situation, and I said this on our Twitter, this is a situation where an athletic department has been used to aid and conceal criminal activities. Mm-hmm. Point blank and period. Somebody has taken an athletic department and used it to aid and conceal criminal activities. If they had been running a prostitution ring, I'd expect some sort of, or whether they had been running drugs through the athletic department, athletic department, and athletic facilities are being used inappropriately. To me, that's the NCAA's realm of jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Do they get to convict Spanier? Do they get to convict Curley? No. But as far as that athletic department, their oversight of the athletic department. If Penn State doesn't like that, they can be NAIA. You know what I mean? They can find another something else to be a part of. But if you're a member institution of the NCAA, you subject yourself to their oversight. And who else oversees an athletic department? The NCAA. So I felt that's how I view it. I think that's where the grounds came for them to make a judgment. And I think as I listened today to some of the national folks talk about it, I think that was the point that they were missing. You know, Jay Billis and Brent Musburger both had some comments about, you know, they didn't think it was within the NCAA's grounds to make this particular ruling. And I disagree. I think the NCAA, again, it's an athletic department. Who oversees the athletic department? When you have the president and the AD using their athletic department to support criminal activity. If they had been running a prostitution ring, or if they had been running drugs, I would expect the NCAA to do something about that, because the athletic department is being used. And in this particular case, it was being used as bait. You know, it was being used as candy. You know, you talk about don't talk to strangers, you know, don't talk to folks offer you candy. This was the candy for this cat. It was the athletic department. It was the football program. I think that's another piece of it that gets kind of glazed over, is that people don't understand that he was using the football program to get these kids to trust him. He was using his connection with the football program to get these kids to engage and, hey, you want to see the locker room? Hey, you want to come check out the weight room? And he's bringing these kids in using the football program, and they knowingly allow him to continue to do that. So that's where I think it was appropriate. I think it was appropriate. I do agree it's heavy-handed as heck, but it was appropriate. Now, coming back to those comments, PhD, you talked about feeling bad for Tom O'Brien. How does he find some success in all of this? Because regardless of the circumstances, you know, I think he was dealt the raw deal. He was dealt a tough hand. I'm sure when he took the job, I'm sure he asked, do you guys expect sanctions? And I would imagine they probably said no, because they didn't think it would go this far, because they've been covering up for so long. How does he find, because now it's his job to make, you know, you got lemons. He has to make lemonade. It's going to be a heck of a batch of lemonade if he can figure it out, but he's got to make some lemonade out of this. So what do you think are some of the first things he needs to do to begin to lay the foundation for a mitigated level of success in this situation, a relative level of success given all the sanctions?
Well, his biggest duty is going to be to develop talent.
develop whoever he brings in, who he has right now, and to convince these young men to stay. So most of the upperclassmen, it's a pretty good chance the seniors are going to stay. They're invested. You know, all three of us have been freshmen on a team or freshmen in a program, and you wait for that senior year because you kind of run a thing just in a year. So those seniors aren't going anywhere. Most of the juniors will probably stay put. It's those freshmen and sophomores that you really got to work on, especially that freshman class that's coming in, because this was a top 10 class. Now, we've already heard rumbles of a couple of players who have decommitted or have backed out of their verbal agreements or have taken the NCAA up on not coming. So that's going to be Coach O'Brien's biggest job. The next thing is convincing his team that, hey, every game is our playoff. And while they won't name us Big Ten champions, guess what? We can win that championship. We'll get our own T-shirts. Okay? I'm not convinced that Penn State won't go a step further and apply some self-imposed sanctions. The NCAA has been hard on them. I think the way that the Penn State is right now, they're looking for PR moves, PR-friendly moves. I wouldn't be surprised if they say, you know what, we're going to take an additional X number of scholarships away from ourselves. Or we're going to take away football for a year. And so I think the key thing is for O'Brien is to figure out what Penn State is going to do from a PR standpoint and how to integrate that from a football standpoint. Because he can't be preaching one thing and then the school announces something a month later. Because think about it. This guy has been preaching things for the 4, 5, 6 months he's been on campus. You know, most of the kids stayed on campus this summer. It seems like they were heading in the right direction. Bam, this hammer comes down. So I think the key thing is to get all the information and then devise a game plan based on the best possible information to save yourself from these kind of bombs that just came from NCAA.
Yeah. Well put, well put. Now, D. Wills, when you were talking, you talked about you'd rather them just take the death penalty than to have to deal with these particular sanctions. Expound for the folks on that particular statement.
It's almost, Phil T. and I talked about this, it's almost like you talk about the corporal punishment, and rather than just putting them in an electric chair and just it's like they gave him a slow injection, and it's taking a while to take effect. And that sometimes is the worst death, because you just like, you wish you would just hammer me. And it sounds like from reports that the way they brought it to him was like, you either take this deal or multiple years of death penalty. I mean, it's like somebody was, you know, they came down on him. But if they had to, if they were to give a death penalty like SMU, which would take basically a year away, no football, no nothing. It, for them, if you're Penn State, you could do a lot of what Phil is talking about. You know, you just wipe the slate clean. You know you're going to lose a number of students, of athletes in terms of transfers. You start building up. You almost build up kind of like Nebraska used to do. You can redshirt some folks. And you can just not die the slow death and have to deal with it. You can take a step back. Reevaluate. I mean, one of the important quotes to look at, Emory says, if you find yourself in a situation where the athletic culture is taking precedent over the academic culture, then a variety of bad things can occur. This is a measure, and I don't know how much the ripple effect is about somehow presidents and chancellors trying to regain some leverage here in this situation. And a death penalty would at least allow the university to kind of take a step back and people kind of really think about where they want the program to go. And then for O'Brien, it would give him a chance to take a breather, to come up with a strategy. So that's why I say it almost felt like it would have felt better just have a year and just no football at all. $100 million sanction for them. Maybe something over the next 10 years, something that would do it if I were in Penn State shoes. But yeah, this is hard to deal with either way, but this is really about the culture of athletics and its impact on campuses. that they're trying to send a message to. I just don't know what the impact of this will have on that issue. You know, I don't know if it's going to have any. And I don't know if it's going to be like the young kid who says, I can make it to the league. It's not going to be me. Or the person who gets, you know, they watch, you know, another athlete get caught in the club. It's not going to be me. You know, sometimes you have a culture of it's not going to be me. And so I don't know how much it's going to resonate with, you know, other major institutions.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. What do we see the impact being? How impactful will this particular – we know it's going to be a landmark situation, but it's such an outlier. Do we think that it's going to have a lasting impact on how schools operate and do business from here on out? PhD, what do you think?
Yeah. I think because of you see how harsh the NCAA was, I think it adds incentive for programs to put in fail safes there, to put in measures to encourage an environment of whistleblowing, to encourage an environment of educating their employees, their coaches, people that work around athletic buildings to say, hey, here's a number, here's a compliance officer that you can call with no questions asked. We don't care if the coach is Joe Paterno. We don't care if the coach is Coach K. We don't care if it's Coach Izzo. We don't care who the artifact is at this university. We want the truth, and we want somebody who can be partial to evaluate if things are right or wrong. So I think in a lot of regards, this is going to motivate athletic departments to really report things, and because they know firsthand what the penalty could be. For a lot of different things, they knew what the penalty were for illegally or going outside the rules of recruiting. And now we're seeing this net, this web, broadcast even wider to non-football type of things, but where the football department, athletic department, certainly has a cast of influence to influence certain things. So, you know, I think that this is what the Penn State situation, from a educational, from a learning standpoint, is really going to put a stamp on other athletic departments because they don't want to be the next Penn State. We know how many years it's going to take to get over this. And, again, this is an egregious situation. But, you know, you talk about sexual assault. I heard Boise State and other schools coming up. Anything, man, these schools are going to be on top of things. They're going to want to self-report rather than having any kind of a illusion of a cover-up.
I want to say that, you know, one of the things that we have to also be careful about is NCAA is a volunteer organization. It's not the NFL. So this could go one or two ways. I mean, NCAA doesn't control BCS, right? I'm understanding this right.
Yeah.
So one of the things that is very the sense that you have to get, if certain folks get a sense that Emory and other folks are really feeling themselves, they're not Goodell.
And they start line stepping.
They start – so – one of the things that they could, the one thing they can do, and we watch this, you know, we've had, you know, when we, you know, have Dr. Sack on, you know, we talk about how we've even gotten to this point. A lot of this is about conferences aligning them and organizing themselves to move away in reaction to the control of the NCAA. So this could go two directions. It could be people realize we need to come together as a community, be supportive, whatever. But in the football community, it could go another way. It could lead to a greater sense of talk, whispers, after the dust clears, about a little bit more control about how they might do, the idea of maybe moving away from NCAA, even more control over football. I mean, I wouldn't discard that.
Okay.
That's one thing. Now, I wouldn't discard that.
Now, both of you raised some points I want to touch base on real quick. Phil, you brought up the point of self-reporting. And I think, again, this is that real sports guy's perspective. This is the renegades, and this is where Like, we've taken it someplace that the mainstream media hasn't taken it yet. Because Phil raised a great point when he talked about self-reporting, and it got me to thinking. Is that, I think that's a big piece of why the NCAA is coming down so hard. I think that's why you're seeing that severity where they were like, you could take multiple years of the death penalty, or you could take this. Because I think for them not self-reporting may have been their biggest crime against the NCAA. Because the NCAA usually is lenient when schools self-report. Even when there are some fairly out there pay-for-play type deals, if you self-report, if you self-sanction, they'll leave it at that. But I think the fact that these cats knew that something of this nature was going on for so long and never said anything and never self-report, never, and not only self-report to NCAA, because NCAA ain't going to do nothing about Sandusky. That's a police issue. But the fact that they didn't report, that idea that, look, if something is going on, you need to come forward. And if you don't come forward, especially for this extended period of time, we're gonna throw several books at you. You know, we're talking about Encyclopedia Britannica size books, which is what happens. So that's one point that I think is an interesting perspective that PAC brought to the table. And then, Devon, I love that idea of the member institutions of the NCAA breaking off and saying, we don't need you anymore. And this may be that tipping point. There's always a point. You know, there's always that straw that breaks the camel's back. The thing that I think prevents NCAA member institutions from doing that, and this is something we talk about a lot, it completely removes the facade of amateurism if they do that. If Ohio State, Michigan, the SEC schools, if these big-time football programs move away from the NCAA and begin to create their own entity to operate, it looks less like the Pollyanna, pie-in-the-sky image that they want to portray of amateurism and academics and athletics mixing in this perfect environment. It removes that. And once it removes that, I think you get a different reaction from people in the communities. I think you get a different reaction from fans as to how they didn't respond to it, because right now there's a very warm and fuzzy, nostalgic feeling to college football, to a Saturday, you know, to a game day Saturday. It's very warm and fuzzy, nostalgic feeling. And then it becomes more professional if you take away that piece of that facade of, look, we're just trying to live under this umbrella, the NCAA, and promote amateurism. It has this mission statement. It's about this, that, and the other. If they move away from it and they say, that's not what we're about anymore, we don't want to be about that because they look too hard on, they're too hard on us when our guys mess up, when our guys don't do it as opposed to they're too hard on us. That looks like, look, we're going to go over here and have this kind of different thing going on so we can keep all the money, make all the money, and do what we want to do and not have to worry about meeting their particular standards and fitting in with their particular mission, which, again, is a mission only in words. You know, I think we all in agreement on that as far as how we feel about the NCAA and their ability to actually execute that mission and how the member institutions are executing that mission. But I think that prevents those schools from going out and branching off. It's because, you know, I had a conversation with somebody about this whole Penn State thing this weekend. It was a parent of one of my basketball players, and we were talking, and we were having this conversation. And, you know, he was one of those people who, you know, I always kind of rolled my eyes at. I don't like the pros because everybody's out to get money, this, that, and the other. And I'm like, well, in college, everybody's kind of out to get money, too. But he's like, yeah, but you got those kids who don't have that opportunity to go pro, who are just there because they want to be there and they want to wear their name on the jersey, and they're going to school and they're getting a free education, all that kind of stuff. But that guy, he believes in that. And that's what keeps him coming back to college football. If these member institutions leave the NCAA, that guy is going to see them differently. He's going to see this whole process differently. And once that happens, I think that hurts their bottom line. What do you think about that, D. Wills?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, they're already taking steps, right? They're taking a little bit more control of how the bowls are operated. You know, they realize, you know, they've had a couple scandals, but that's kind of the scandals was a smokescreen to get control of the money. But they realize they're outsourcing to these folks, had all this control in which the leagues, the conferences could have more control of that money. You can already see they're positioning themselves around how they're doing this bowl. And, and then, you know, this new playoff format and all this stuff. So that position has happened. You know, sometimes I equate it to kind of like what happened with Wall Street, right? Outroar, everything else went. There was, you had Occupy Wall Street, everything else. But over the past, three or four years, you had some of the largest bonuses given out in the banking industry, in the finance industry, right? People still having parties. And so I think part of it is watching how the dust settles, because it's a slow maneuver. It's a slow, it's like the Big Ten commissioner, the whole thing that came up about possibly, you know, being able to hire or fire coaches. I mean, you know, these kind of, and I'm like, that's ridiculous. What chancellor would give you the freedom to have that kind of freedom with their football coach? So I don't discount it. I think it will happen in subtleties. It'll happen in, you know, if it is going to happen, it'll happen. Let's control the bowl system a little bit more. Let's control the revenue around that a little bit more. Let's lock in what this playoff system is going to look like. And then we'll push this other maneuver. And so, you know, I think, you know, you just got to keep your eye on it. I'm hoping it's going to go in the direction that this should do for folks in terms of pull it closer into what that true student-athlete, you know, kind of environment that we want to be closer to the academic core of the university. And I think the NCAA is coming down with some sanctions that are really going to be pushing, you know, a greater engagement in a greater into a larger campus community. You're already seeing some provosts and chancellors talking about people being under the same summer code of ethics to make sure as other units on the campus have to be under. So some of that's happening, but if you have the right group of powerful folks, I mean, SEC country, that's a powerful country. Big Ten country, that's a powerful body of folks. You know, depending on where those folks go will really dictate where this debate goes, especially the Big Ten, the Pac-12, and SEC are going to be major players in terms of where this is going to go.
Good points. Now, you're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, RSG Renegade Radio. We're in the midst of the funky editorial. We're breaking down the sanctions, the NCAA sanctions that have been placed upon Penn State. As we begin to wrap up this particular conversation and this particular segment of the show, I want PhD to close us out. You know, he's gonna be the closer. He's gonna be Kobe for a moment. PhD, my brother, break down how long does it take Penn State to overcome this? We know the obstacles. How long does it take them to overcome this? They have a 4-year bowl ban. They're going to be restricted on scholarships. How long will it take them to dig themselves out of this particular situation before we see Penn State competing at a top 25 level again?
I got my hand in your face. I got my hand in your face.
2018 at the latest. And a lot of people are saying 10 years, 15 years. I don't see it. I think, yes, recruiting will take a dip, but Coach O'Brien or whoever's there is going to have the selling point. A year or two into this 4-year ban, you know, especially year three, year four, they're going to be able to recruit kids and say, hey, wait a minute. You know that we've been recruiting inferior players. You know, 2-star, 3-stars are playing for us right now. You know, you're a 4-star recruit, you're a 5-star recruit, you can come in and play right away. And I think by the time 2017, 2018, they will be a couple of years out of that band, and these 4- or 5-star recruits will be sophomores, juniors, and I think they'll be right back, you know, in a top 15 type of program like they are right now.
Yeah. Hey. And you know what else is going to be a great selling point after a couple years? You want to be a part of the group that brought us back.
That's right.
You know, you want to be a part of the group that brought this back, because you're going to go down in history in this program, in this state, as a part of those teams and a part of that recruiting class that brought this school back. So that's always going to be, after a couple years, I think you're right. I don't think it's going to take as long as people think. You know, USC has been able to maintain a level of success and has been able to convince their players, hey, look, if you were a sophomore when the sanctions, you know, came down, if you hang around for 2 years, this is where I'm at Barkley State. If you hang around for 2 years, we can get you. You know, that your last year will give you a chance, will give you a shot to play in a national championship. So, no, my man PhD closed it down. He beat the buzzer. Great points. Again, you listen to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, RSG Renegade Radio. Just wrapping up a conversation, a great conversation, fellas, on everything that's gone down at the University of Penn State. This is a little bit less of a yucky conversation than some of the other conversations we've had. You know, this is a very difficult topic to talk about. This is a little bit easier to talk about than some of the other things that went down in this particular situation. I know we've all had a wide range of opinions as to how things should be handled and what's going down. And we're going to continue to monitor the situation. We're going to continue to inform you guys, our listeners out there, as to how we feel about how things continue to transpire and how all this plays out. You know, I think my man PhD is one of the biggest proponents of we need time. We need time to see what's what, who's who, and how everything shakes down in the end. And I think with this particular Penn State situation, we're in like chapter two of what's going to be a really long book. So we just need to buckle up because it's going to be interesting to see how Coach O'Brien and the folks at Penn State rally around their team, rally around their program, and work to put this whole situation behind them, move forward, begin to heal as a community, begin to heal as a football program, and also begin to provide some inspiration for folks. And hopefully they can turn this situation into a positive. I know things look bleak right now. But overall, I'm hoping that the community there in State College can really rally around this team and they can figure out a way overall as a university community to turn this into a positive situation. So we're going to keep on trucking, keep the show moving right on along. We're going to talk a little golf right now. Can you listen to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com? The British Open this weekend was won by Ernie Els, who had a come-from-behind victory over Adam Scott. Now, I'm going to toss it to my man, D. Wills. I want you to break down where Scott went wrong. D. Wills is kind of our resident golf guy, all right? He's been trying to talk me into getting on the links. I'm just not really a golf cat. But he's been working on me. He's been working on me for a couple of years, and I'm just not budging. But I'm gonna pass it to my man D. Wills and let him do what he do.
I mean he had a pretty good lead in the final round. I mean, I think he had five bogeys down the stretch. He was, I think, going into his last two holes, he was up one or two. You know, he just found himself in bunkers. I mean, he was hitting accurate most of the open, and you know, all of a sudden the wheels fell off. And you know, he has Tiger's former caddy who's a veteran, so he had a good person in his corner. His putter went away from him. He does that belly putt. I don't know if you guys have ever seen it. You know, I've tried that, everyone. You know, you get this big tall putter, you got it in your stomach, you got your arm right down there. I mean, he it's a young, it don't look like the kind of putter a young cool cat like that should have. You know, stylistic. So far, that's a stylistic thing. And then Ernie Els is a vet, and he knew all he had to do is keep, you know, even at his age, he still can get range on the ball and get it out there. Take some shots, and he, you know, like a crafty vet, he just kept putting the pressure on him. And so, you know, getting the bunker, he got in a bunker, I believe it was either an 18 or whatever, and those bunkers, you get up close, you can't get out, up and out. You got to keep sideways. So if you got to hit sideways, then that's a stroke you got to give up. So those type of mistakes he wasn't making. And, you know, like they always say, you know, pressure, you know, can bust pipes, and it busts pipes on him. I mean, you got to feel sorry for a young guy like that who's trying to emerge into that elite level, he was so comfortable. He was up like four shots, you know. So some of the most the most significant collapses in sports actually have happened in golf. And part of it is you're the only one out there. Once you make a mistake, it's not like a team. You can lean on somebody. Somebody might pick up or somebody gets shot. It's you. Everybody's watching you, and you either stand in the moment or you shrink in the moment, and he shrank in the moment.
Yeah, he did shrink in the moment. And shrinkage is a common problem among some sports athletes when it gets cold outside and the pressure's on. With that said, we each came up with a list of our five most memorable. And this is a personal list. This isn't saying he's the worst of all time. This is just our personal list of our most memorable choke jobs in sports. Now, I'll give mine first, and then PhD, you hop in, and then D-Wheels, you take a turn at it. My number five, being in Wisconsin, this one was huge for me, just because of the circumstances around it. You know, franchise icon Brett Favre leaves the Green Bay Packers in a very contentious, very difficult situation. Goes to the arch rival, the Minnesota Vikings, has one of his best statistical seasons ever. Just sets the world on fire for the Vikings this season. Gets him to the NFC Championship 2009, and in true Brett Favre fashion, throws a pick. Not just a pick six to lose the game. So that's my number five choke job. The brother didn't have any reason to throw the ball in this particular situation other than the fact that he was Brett Favre, and that's what Brett Favre does. So he threw the ball. He could have ran. He could have just slid, and they would have kicked the field goal and won the game. But instead, Brett Favre being Brett Favre, he choked. All right? And in this particular situation, for my particular list, I classify choke the situations where you beat yourself. You have everything there to win the game, and you beat yourself. Those are choke jobs. And then people that continually get to places, they have a block. Whether it's a team that continually gets to the finals, a team that continually gets to the championship game and can't win it, those qualify as chokes to me, because at some point you have to climb that mountain and get over that hurdle. So that's my number five. My number four, the five Slammer Jammer Houston Cougars. All right, I had to dig deep on that one. Three straight Final Fours, all right? This is a team that got to three straight Final Fours, had two NBA Hall of Famers, two College Basketball Hall of Famers in Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler, and they lost their last trip on one of the most amazing plays in college basketball history. They lost to NC State, and the reason I call it a choke is because this is a team that was veteran. They were senior laden. They were in the championship game. This is their third trip to the Final Four, and they lose on a fluke play. And to me, I call it a choke because in that situation, you have a veteran team. You know, in that situation, we just need to be solid. Everybody needs to keep their heads about themselves, do their job, block out, be solid, and we win this game. But they didn't. They got caught up in the moment. Guys weren't on their job as far as their assignments defensively. You got a guy sneak in for a quick put back at the buzzer. Game over. You guys lose again. So I got them as my number four choke. My number three choke. My number three greatest choke of all time. You guys might remember this. The Dave and Dan commercials back in the early 90s. Dan O'Brien. Dan O'Brien, a decathlete, and he was picked as he was going into the 92 Olympics. He was the favorite to be gold medal as a decathlete. He was being touted as the greatest athlete in the world, and up until in the USA Olympic trials, up until he had the pole vault, it was looking like he was going to the Olympics. But he had three attempts at the height of 15'9", and his brother could not make it. He had three attempts, and he missed on all of them, a height that he had breached before, a height that he had made over before. But because he did not make it over on any of those attempts, he got a zero in that event, which dropped him to 12th place. And that's the story of Dan O'Brien. So, and again, the Reebok commercial, I think it was Reebok, the Reebok commercials of him and the other cat, Dave, I think Dave Jansen was the dude's name. You know, they pumping these two dudes up for months before the games. Months before the games, they got these Dave and Dan commercials, and then Dan doesn't make it. He don't even make the Olympics, let alone not get a gold medal. But he did redeem himself in 96 where he did get a gold medal. But 92 was a major fail and a choke job. Number two on my list, the 2003 Chicago Cubs. These guys were up on the Florida Marlins. I think in game six, they were up. They were winning. And this is the Bartman game. All right? This is the Bartman game. Bartman interferes with a ball that Moises Alou should have caught. Because he interferes, the ball gets Moises Alou doesn't catch the ball, doesn't get the last out in the inning. The Marlins continue to go on and score, I think, six more runs in this inning. And take the lead and eventually win that game. Now, at that particular moment, when that happened, and I'm a White Sox fan, which is why I have this moment here. Let me make that clear, all right? I can't stand the Cubs. I dislike everything about the Cubs, all right? So I'm driving along. I'm working at Missions at Beloit College, and I'm driving back to Beloit from Peoria. Just did a college fair. I'm driving back, so I'm listening to the game on the radio. And the moment that that happened, because Cub fans are a special breed. Cub fans, to me, are a special breed of people. They're a special breed of sports fans, all right? They like to go to Wrigley, get plastered, and they don't even pay attention to the game. And, again, for me, this was a perfect example of that. In that moment, this is what I felt in that moment. Now, we've learned more about Bartman and his situation. But in that moment, when that happened, I'm listening to this game on the radio. I'm like, typical Cubs fan, not even realizing, dude, move. Let Alou catch the ball. They're so drunk and plastered that they're not paying attention to the game. That wouldn't happen at that time at U.S. Cellular. That wouldn't happen at the sale. Why? Because White Sox fans actually pay attention to baseball. That's it.
Good job.
That's it. At that moment, I knew the fragile Cubs. You can call them Cubs. I just call them a fragile franchise. They're the fragile franchise, all right? The north side of Chicago is fragile. It's a fragile side of town. I'm a south sider, all right? The fragile franchise did what they did. They folded up. They couldn't take it. They blamed this goof, this Cub fan. They blame a fan. All your fans are like that. Any of your fans in the stadium would have done the same thing because they're all blitzed out of their mind off old style and Schlitz. All right? They gone. They gone. So fitting, they choked the series, wind up losing, and the curse continues. All right? Not so lovable losers, in my opinion. My number one choke job, 1992 Houston Oilers. Now, this team featured one of my favorite quarterbacks of all time, Warren Moon. They were going against the Buffalo Bills. At halftime, they had Buffalo down 35 points. All right? Not only is Buffalo down 35 points, but their starting quarterback, Jim Kelly, has been injured. Jim Kelly, Hall of Famer, one of the greatest quarterbacks of his era, has been injured and has been taken out of the game. And now the backup quarterback is in the game. So not only do you have a 35-point lead, you got the backup, Frank Reich, coming in the game. Right? What does Buffalo do? They reel off 36 consecutive points to win the game. You play to win the game. All right. Buffalo comes back and wins the game. So I have the Houston Oilers. And I remember watching that game and thinking they are not going to lose. Because I'm rooting for Houston because I'm a Moon fan. I was a Warren Moon fan. This is when they had, you know, Haywood Jeffries. And they had Webster Slaughter, not Webster Slaughter. They had Ernest Givens. They had Ernest Duncan. And they had a great receiving core around Warren Moon. And they were running a running shoot. And they would just chuck the ball all over the field. And I was really hoping that they would get far in the playoffs so I could see Warren Moon get a Super Bowl ring. But the Bills got him. So that's my number one choke job, my most memorable choke job. PhD, give us your five.
This was somewhat tough for me, but I did my top five based on the impact it had on me. Okay, and I won't spend a whole lot of time on the stuff you already covered. And in no particular order. Well, you know what? I will give it an order in terms of impact to me. So 2003 Cubs, the whole Bartman thing, I'll just move, slide right on over that one. Number four, the Red Sox crashing and burning in 2003 to the Yanks. I'm a huge Yankee fan. A lot of people out there know that I'm a diehard Yanks fan. And so I love that one. But in 2004, when the Yanks gave up that 3-0 lead to Boston, whoo, talk about the lowest of the lows, man. I was just, man, people were texting me. I mean, it was venom. This was back in 04. This is when text messaging was starting to get hot, okay? You know, right now, you know, everybody mom and dad text. Well, not 8 years ago. I wasn't, you know, everybody was kind of getting new to text. And I think a lot of people sent their very first text message, and it was to me, laughing at me because the Yankees blew a 3-0 lead. So that's my number three. My number two would be the New York Mets in 07. 7.5-game lead with 15 games left, and they blew it. Willie Randolph, I believe, was the manager. And, you know, it was really tough for me because I was such a fan of Willie. But some of the moves they made, you know, David Wright, it was just unbelievable. They were just finding ways to lose. And the biggest choke of all time that just, I mean, it broke my 12, 13-year-old heart was the Fab Five, C-Webb calling the timeout in the national championship game their sophomore year against North Carolina. I can't talk about it, so I'm just going to move on.
That's a quality list. That's a quality list right there, man. It sounds like there was some true genuine embarrassment and heartbreak in that list for you, man.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm trying to work through it, man. I'm still trying to work through it.
We're going to help you get through it. We're going to be holding therapy sessions after this, man, for all of us who bring up some of those personal choke jobs that really had a tremendous impact on us. B. Wills.
In my list, I try to mix some more recent and some historical ones in my list to kind of highlight. My five is actually the Red Sox, what I call it, the chicken and beer collapse, most recently, when they had that led to Francona's firing, where they had that amazing lead, and they were coming down, and they had that series where they basically just lost it to Tampa. And I remember watching that game and just going, what is going on with that? And then the ripple effect off of that game in terms of leading to the firing, leading to all the changes, all the offseason stuff, was I had to get a recent one that I think as you look back on it is going to be one. The Music City Miracle, I think that one was just amazing. Frank Wright was incredible, one of the best backups in NFL history. I love that one. The British Open, golf has a lot of collapses. I mean, you could probably build a list on golf. But you had, I remember John Van De Velde, where he had a 3-shot lead on the 18th hole. The one of the greatest shots, if you ever look at it, is where he's standing in the middle of the bunker with his ball is kind of sitting in water. But he's got a 3-shot lead in the 18th hole, just totally folds, goes into a playoff, loses. In golf, you got Greg Norman, the Shark, has some incredible ones. And then the Cubs, the curse. I mean, I loved being around here. People just knew Cubs were going to World Series. And that was – I felt bad for Dusty, but that stuff was comical. I mean, I hear Game Changer throwing a little south side of jab on them. But that one is up there all time for me. And then the Pinstripes losing to the Red Sox is monumental. You know, that's one where you just have to you're like, I can't believe that's something that the Yankees just didn't do. I mean, if the Yankees got a stranglehold on you, that was it. And the Red Sox wasn't the kind of organization they ever covered. So, I'm sorry, I'm trying to do that to you. And then I think that's my five, but I also would say I would add that Fab Five one from a personal one is a painful one, so I will keep that one moving.
Yeah, you know, as I was thinking about this and I was doing research about this, you know, one that I always forget about, I had this kind of in my honorable mention section, was Nick Anderson. You remember when he missed all the free throws?
Yeah,
he was never the same.
It ruined him.
You know, as an Illini fan going way back, Nick Anderson was one of my childhood heroes. And, you know, Orlando was in the, I think it was in the Eastern Conference Finals, man, and he missed like six straight free throws. And he never could shoot free throws again after that. And he never was a bad free throw shooter before that. But
yeah.
Some of those moments ruin guys, man.
Man, the video game rating for Nick Anderson, I remember. It was like NBA Live 94. He was a great shooter. And then 95 or the year after whatever that happened, I mean, he was horrific. He was worse than Shaq at the free throw line. I mean, it was tough. That little line was going so fast, man, you couldn't even make a shot with that guy.
And it was all from like a 2 minute span, man. It was all from like a 2 minute span. It's craziness. You know, him and Charles Smith both came to mind when I was thinking about this for the New York Knicks. You remember Charles Smith with his 75 pump fakes and no made layups, no converted layups.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, classic moments.
Yeah,
these are some of those.
The look on his face, too, was just classic. He just looked like somebody needed to give him a hug.
Yeah, he wanted out, man. He wanted out of that game. Those are some of the classic choke jobs in the history from the Renegades perspective. You're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, RSU Renegade Radio. We're going to get into the five on the black-hand side.
Five on the black-hand side.
Now, for this week's five on the black-hand side, we are each going to give you our top five wide receivers. As we continue to give you our top players at each position, as we approach the NFL season, we're going to go through every position and give you the top five players going into the 2012 season. Guys, we think are going to perform at a top five level. They may not be top five, may not have been top five last year, but we feel like this year, for whatever reason, these guys are going to be top five. First guy I want to step up to the mic and give us his top five is PAC. Roll with it, man.
All right, my top five, in no particular order, is I believe Larry Fitzgerald is up for a huge season. You know, he had somewhat of a down season this past year, but I think the quarterback situation is going to have a little more clarity. I think Cobb will be better this year. So I think Larry Fitzgerald will go back to his normal ways. Next, Brandon Marshall. I think Brandon Marshall will solidify himself as a top five receiver this year. Going back to Chicago or going back with Cutler at Chicago, I think that he's going to make a lot of big plays and to make us remember just what a threat he was three seasons ago. After that, I'm coming with Greg Jennings. I think the emergence of Jordy Nelson is the defenses are going to pay a lot more attention to Nelson than they have in the last couple of years. And Greg Jennings is still the number one option there. But I think he's going to have more one-on-one chances and looks, especially with Finley coming back and some of the other weapons that they have. Then, you know, it's Calvin Johnson, Andre Johnson. Andre Johnson had a down season because of the injuries, hamstrings, and knees and so forth. And Megatron is just a beast. So
those two guys are on the top of just about every possible list. And Fitzgerald, I think, is going to reestablish himself to be in that conversation as well.
Man, that's a good list, man. I like Fitz. You know, Jennings is one I did have on my list. He was, for me, was a when I got to 4 and 5, man, it was about 5 or 6 moves that I think are all really, really, really good. And I was having a hard time deciding who's gonna have a better season out of those guys. I can't argue with nothing you said about Jennings, man, and it makes me wish I had him in my list. D. Wills, can you give me your list?
Now, Phil T. got Jennings because that's some home cooking. Somewhere around there.
Yeah, man, Dennis is good. Yeah, it is, but Dennis can ball.
No, I bet.
Dude has got a bone.
KZU in the house. What's up to all my KZU people out there?
I love it. I was going to put Jennings in, and I think he's got some other weapons around him. I think he's a great receiver, and he just went out 6 for me. So at 5, I think Steve Smith is going to continue. He had a really good year last year. I think he's going to come back this year and play even better. I think he's just getting himself right, and I think he's going to continue to – he's got another one – he's got another couple of good seasons in him at an elite level. My number 4, and just looking at lists, so I was going to switch between 4 and 5 between this next one. I'm not a big fan of this guy, but I think if their team – is going to make it deep into the playoffs, he's got to have a big season. And that's Roddy White. I think Julio Jones's development will open up opportunities for Roddy to do his thing. And I just think for their team to be successful long term, he's got to just be a beast in crunch time for them. I just think Ryan's going to need him, and he's just got to perform. I think the other ones we probably all agree with. Andre Johnson, you know, I think injuries there, but he's a beast. I think he's going to come back strong. They got a dynamic offense. He's just a beast, hard to catch. He's also got a division that's going through some transitions, so I think he's going to eat big. He's going to eat a lot playing within his division. Larry Fitzgerald, I think, is just going to have a bounce back. I think they've made some moves, and he's just tough to stop. He's physical. He's willing. The top two guys can do whatever you want them to do. And then Megatron, you know, Lions, Detroit, you know, I grew up in the area, like the Lions, but, you know, my trivia question, name a Lions coach, a person that's coached the Lions and gone on to coach another team. Just not going to find somebody. It hasn't happened. Mariucci may be the first, but they've never had one. And then the organization is turning around. Its culture is turning around. And a lot of it has to do with Calvin Johnson. And he just can do everything. He just beats people up. He outruns them. He outjumps them. So that's my list.
All right. Again, that's another real good list, man. You know, you run in, again, Roddy White was another guy who was right on the fringe for me, man. I love his game. I love his – he has very much a hard hat, lunch pail kind of attitude about – playing his position. He goes out there, he works hard. You know, he's got Julius Jones developing on the other side. Matt Ryan's just got to put it together, man. And, you know, he's one of those guys who's always in that conversation, but rarely gets that recognition as one of the top guys at his position. But he's always mentioned. My list, I have at number 5, I have A.J. Green of the Cincinnati Bengals.
Ooh.
This guy had an excellent rookie season for a wide receiver, which is a very difficult position to transition into. He and his quarterback hooked up a lot. Andy Dalton, they hooked up a lot. He emerged as a legitimate target in the red zone. I think that's going to continue. They're going to have a tougher schedule this year, which I think may present a challenge overall for the team, but I think he's going to continue to ascend to the top of the league. He just has so much talent. I really like watching him play. Really good route runner, and he can go up in the air and get to balls most guys can't get to as far as his ability to get up in the air jumping. That's one guy. Number 4, I got Brandon Marshall. Again, PhD said it all. I think hooking up with Cutler, I think we're going to see the Brandon Marshall we saw in Denver. I think he's going to get triple-digit receptions, close to 1,300, 1,400 yards, maybe even get double-digit touchdowns. Touchdowns could be fickle, though. Andre Johnson, I think he's had, by his standards, a couple of down years because of injury. Injuries has always been an issue. I think this is just a make-or-break year for that whole franchise out there in Houston. And every year has been a make-or-break year for them for the last couple of years. But I think right now their players are getting to the point where they're at a tipping point as a franchise. Andre Johnson's not a spring chicken anymore. He's not old, but he's also not young. Same with Shaw. Same with some guys on their defense. These guys are that core group of guys that's been together for a while. They already lost Mario Williams on defense. They already lost D'Amico Ryans on defense, guys who have been the foundation of that defense for quite some time. That era of guys is beginning to phase out. And so for those that core group, this is their time. And I think Johnson's going to step up this year and really have kind of one of another big year before I think we start to see his production slip a little bit. Number two, Megatron. I can't say nothing that hasn't already been said. Dude's a beast, period, exclamation point. At number one, I got Larry Fitzgerald, the most professional guy out there, work ethic like no other. I expect him to reestablish himself as the number one guy in the league. I think they're going to get their quarterback situation figured out enough where he can function. Again, he had a great season by most other guys' standards last year with a real shaky quarterback situation. If that situation settles down a little bit and they get an average level of play from their quarterback, this dude is going to lead the league in receptions. He's going to catch double-digit touchdowns. And he's going to catch 1,200 to 1,500 yards. Put it down in the book. So those are our top five receivers. You listen to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, RSG Renegade Radio. Our top five receivers going into the 2012 season. That's the five on the black hand side, and we're going to keep things rolling. All right, so next up we have, we want to talk a little bit about the Olympics. Now, we're the Real Sports Guy, you know, and we're as far as our sports go, we're pretty meat and potatoes kind of cats. All right, for the most part, we're those meat and potato guys. We like our football, our basketball, baseball, you know, we're talking boxing, we're talking golf with you. We kind of keep everything kind of right on our plate, all right? Then the Olympics rolls around. The Olympics come around every 4 years. And there's some things, you know, we might get a little cute, you know. Might get a little cute with our sports menu. You know, we might throw a little something in there that you wouldn't typically think a real sports guy would be into. Each of us has those kind of events that we like when Olympic time comes around. And we have those little kind of out-of-the-box things that we look forward to watching that you really wouldn't think a real sports guy would be into. So we're going to share some of those with you as we begin to talk about and get you in the mindset of the Olympics, which starts this weekend. The open ceremonies are going to be on the 27th. I know the basketball, the first Team USA game, which is one of the things that one of my prime attractions, begins on the 29th. But there are going to be so many events going on. It's going to be so much to watch. It's really one of my favorite times of year. You know, you get just wall-to-wall sports all day, which is really, really, you know, for me, it's really fun, and I really enjoy that. But for those off-kilter, out-of-the-box sports that we like to watch during the Olympics, I'm going to talk to my man D. Wills and then have PhD jump in, and I'll close it out. D. Wills, what's that off-the-radar sport that you'll be tuned into during the Olympics this year?
You know, it's one of gymnastics is one that I always watch. I watch the trials. Sometimes in the household, my wife, my daughter, I'm watching the trials. And so gymnastics is good. I mean, we got a good women's team going over there, and we got a good men's. The men's team is actually being led by two men of color. One is Leva. He's a Cuban immigrant. I watched him, and then the other kid is from the Bronx. He's from these are sports that usually are in the suburbs, but this kid is from the Bronx, and I enjoy watching him in the trials. They got a good team, good 1-2 punch. The women's team, I think, looks like it's a little bit stronger because I think they got two top all-around folks, but they got some specialists. So I watch a little gymnastics. I'm talking about it like I'm trying to break down the Steelers. I get that going. The other thing, because my daughter does it, synchronized swimming. You know, she's got her Tiger Woods on. And so I got to watch that because now I understand a little bit more of what they're doing. And so that might be something that you might see me flip on when they do the mixed channels. I might clip in the Japanese and the Chinese. They make that thing rock. You get on YouTube and check some of the stuff out they're doing. It's crazy. So those are two that you would catch D. Wills when he's on his softer side trying to understand. And I'm telling you, the most brutal critics you ever find in sports is gymnastics folks. They talk about it. That was a stick out of 4 or 5. They had to stick. I'm like, dang, they critical. And the person just twists and did a triple flip, and it barely landed on the toenail, and they ran up the spot.
That's what I'm talking about. The real sports guy. That's what I'm talking about. PhD. Give me that sport for you, man. D. Wills has the gymnastics. What's your sport?
I'm looking forward to archery. Okay.
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 I'm going to check it out. Do tell.
I'm looking forward to archery. And, you know, I think this goes back to my childhood Dukes and Hazzard upbringing. You know, Bo and Luke will be quick. Bo and Luke will be real quick to bring out that bow and arrow and just blow up a building. I never quite understood how you get a bow and you get an arrow and they hit a building and then they get a big explosion. I never added up to me. Chemistry, physics, whatever it is. I never got it, but it, you know. It looked cool.
You're killing me over here, man.
Because
they would do that. They would really do that.
Yeah, you know.
He's not exaggerating.
Old Luke would go be sitting on his window on the passenger side. The General Lee is hitting 85 on bumpy country roads, yet he's concentrating and hitting bullseye. Okay. So I'm guessing, because I really had to do some soul searching to figure out, why do I take an interest in archery? And I'm not kidding, man. You know, and it's a challenge to figure out when NBC is going to show archery, because that's one of those sports they just kind of toss in when they got a spare minute. You know, okay, there's a timeout in USA Basketball. Let's send it to Jerry for a quick archery update. You have a hard time to really catch them. So I'm looking forward to archery at Lord's Cricket Ground. The next thing for me is swimming. The diving, the swimming, it's just so cool how, like Devon alluded to earlier, how the attention to detail, like we talk about in football and a lot of sports that we cover, preparation. Man, the attention to detail in sports such as diving, there's just no comparison. You know, you look at what Michael Phelps has done on the swimming side of it, and one false move costs you a quarter of a second, a tenth of a second, you're done. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the diving team compete, but also on the swimming side, I'm looking forward to see Michael Phelps, if he can do what he did last Olympics, or at least get a gold or two. And then gymnastics. Blame it on Dominique Dawes. Had a crush on her in the 96.
We all did, man. Join the club.
Yeah. So I'll just cut it short at that one.
All right. Well, you know, I'm going to follow my man Phil T and say, yes, diving is something that I'm really excited to watch. Again, I don't really follow. It's not a sport I follow, but like you said, man, the attention to detail, the precision, and, you know, the one thing that I feel like I'm a great judge of when I'm watching diving is the splash. Like, I'll be watching with my wife. I'm like, nope, that was too much splash. That was way too much.
Too much splash.
That wasn't a good time. That was way too much splash. Nah, man. But then I'm like, okay, yeah, the judge is going to get out about an 8, man. That splash wasn't right. You know, that's the one thing that I feel like I'm a good judge, decent judge at, man. Everything else I can't catch. The arch of the back, whether the arms are appropriately placed, you know, whether the body leans or it goes, I can't catch all that, man. It happens too fast, and my eye ain't trained. But that splash, they go in that water. I can tell you, no. That wasn't a good dive. When they go in, it looks like you dropped a rock in the water. That's 10. That's a 10 right there. You know, so diving is one that I feel like I enjoy watching it, and I can get into that. The other one I like, I'm going to keep this one real short, beach volleyball.
Oh, yeah.
Y'all know why.
Yeah.
Let it roll. And then another one I enjoy is the rowing. I actually like to watch the rowing. You know, it's one that, you know, it requires a lot of teamwork. There's definitely a bit of strategy to it. And I like to kind of watch the role of the person who's at the front of the boat, you know, and they're yelling row. And, you know, it's different teams are trying to, you're trying to pace yourself, and you're also trying to judge the other teams. I think it's definitely a sport that requires a lot and lots of teamwork and timing. So I like watching the rowing. So those are my three. You know, I get into the diving, the beach volleyball, and then the rowing. So those are the ones that I did.
And I'll add, you know, thanks to Bernie Mac, rest in peace, rhythmic gymnastics.
You went there.
One of the best episodes ever of Bernie.
Yes. Classic. Definitely a classic. If you haven't seen a Bernie Mac show, you got to check that out. Bernie Mac, one of the best comics of all time. Comedic genius. One of the original kings of comedy. Man, y'all remember when that came out? Original Kings of Comedy?
Yeah.
Oh.
Did you go see that at the theater?
How much time we got left? We got time. Man, I have not laughed so hard ever. Ever. I'm not calling another dude delicious. I'm just not doing it. Hey, yo, dude.
Hey, yo, delicious. Yo.
Nah, I ain't doing that.
Yeah, you can just call me.
Man, I took a young lady, man. I was about 17, 18 when that came out, man. And I took a young lady friend to see that, man. And I didn't make a move. I was too busy laughing, man. I didn't even execute the game plan. I forgot what I was there for, man. I'm high-fiving the dude in front of me, man. I'm laying over in the aisle, man. It was... You know, I went and saw it in a hood theater with other black folks, man. And it was an event, man. Everybody was there, man. It was crazy, man. And people was cracking up. That was one of those moments, man, where you just remember that moment, man. If you went to see that, again, for you young cats out there, Original Kings of Comedy, great comedy movie, man. If you can get that in, get in your Eddie Murphy Raw. Martin, you go crazy. You know, go back, get you some Richard Pryor, get you some Red Box, get you some Dick Gregory. You got your comedy bases covered right there, man. Then you throw in your Chappelle, right? Get you a season of the Chappelle Show, and you got your comedy chops right there. That's how you cut your comedy teeth if you're a young cat, man. You go look that up. You go through that regimen, and you'll be right as far as the comedy goes. You can hang with the real sports guys. We'll drop a reference all the time. I think PAZ just dropped the delicious reference on text the other day.
Yeah.
And it's still funny.
Every time he says that, that's his favorite line. Every time he says it, I laugh.
Oh, yeah. If you execute it properly, you always get a laugh out of that one, my man.
That's right. I like the Bernie Mac part as well, man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We talk about the kids. The little one.
Old Bernie parlayed that into a sitcom, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yep.
That's how you got to do, man. Yeah, those cats were, they're all still doing really well, man. Said, DL, you know, Steve Harvey's totally taking his career and taking it in a whole different direction. Probably.
Yeah.
He's really branding himself well. Those cats, man, yeah, it was great to see those cats come out and do that, man. That was one of those moments, man. That was one of those cultural moments that, you know, you look back on and you're like, yeah, I was there. I remember when that happened. Original, you young cats, check that out.
It's nothing like watching. I remember watching Bernie Mac live up in Minneapolis. I think it was either before a Final Four weekend or NBA All Star weekend. Just in tears. Just a legendary cat, man. And you know, we just lost Sherman Hemsley today from George Jefferson, and another person in terms of his commitment to television. So, hey, there's some great comics out there. People who've added a lot to our. To our lives, the real sports guys.
Absolutely. So, transitioning from the original kings of comedy, we're going to talk about a little bit of comedy. We're going to talk a little bit about the Adrian Broner fight for a moment. Now, I want to check on this. Just check the post. We had Doug Fisher from Ring Magazine on last week. He came on with the real sports guys, and we talked a lot of boxing. We talked about 45 minutes, almost an hour of boxing. Great conversation. Doug was amazing. If you get a chance, head over to Ring Magazine, ringmagazine.com, and check some of Doug's work, check some of the things they got going on over there. Really great site. It's the Bible of boxing. You go there, you get your information, you cut your teeth, you get your chops right, you be all up to date on what's going on in the boxing world. Doug joined us last week. Now, in that conversation, we didn't have a chance to get Doug's opinion on the young fighter, 22-year-old, undefeated, Adrian Broner. He had a big fight this weekend on HBO. Now, this young man has been touted as the next Floyd for many reasons. One, Broner, he has a similar boxing style to Floyd. He has a very similar boxing style. His stance is very similar. He has a very similar defensive technique. He kind of uses that shoulder, that left shoulder to kind of protect his chin and kind of cuts his head behind there. He's also got a ton of personality. Very flamboyant, very out there, very demonstrative. Now, D. Wills, I know you had a chance to see the fight, right? Did you see the fight?
Yeah.
So you saw the fight. So, break it down for me. Your initial impressions of Adrian Broner. He fought Vicente Escobedo this weekend. He came into the fight a little bit overweight. He was at 135. Escobedo was at 130, which kind of caused some issues, but they still had the fight. What did you think of? How did this fight go, in your opinion?
Well, Escobedo was coming down I think it was 130. Because, you know, he'd had some great fights, I believe up at 135, but, you know, he just was not able to handle some of those fighters up there. So he's coming down and to really try to establish himself at 130. And Broner, this is what Broner came in overweight and made it really clear that he really didn't care. And one of the things that was interesting about it is, and you talk about the how much he's like Floyd, is one of the things I think Broner's understood early in his life. Yeah, he's got to win some belts, but being recognized and being branded has nothing to do with the belts, right? So he really didn't care about losing that junior lightweight belt. You know, what he understood is he has a developing brand, and so he was ready to vacate that already. He's already planning to go to 135. Didn't really matter to him. He'd already done what he needed to do at 130. So he understands what Floyd understands. Holding belts don't mean anything as long as you're in the pound-to-pound conversation. I mean, that's what they understand. And that's what drove the way he was acting that night. But this kid, The one thing I think he has that you might not see as much in the Floyd, and people might say that's blasphemy, is that what makes him good is that he's more willing to engage than Floyd. So what makes Floyd is so slick and is willing to, counter all the time. What Broner is, this cat goes to the body. He went to the body, broke him down to the head. He's willing to exchange at times. And that gives him a little different edge along with the fact that he's a straight clown. The big thing was when he had his girl there and he kneeled down like he was going to propose to her. And if you didn't see the fight, you got to see this. And everybody thought he was going to propose, and he asked her to brush his hair. His timing is impeccable. This kid has got it all, man. And he's going to do big things. And I'm not worried about the fact he didn't make weight. He understands how to position himself as a big-money fighter. And he's got all the tools. I mean, he's going to have some big fights here pretty quickly. And even if he would have come in weight, it still would have the same outcome.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I like his showmanship. He even had a little rope-a-dope move in the ring. He won on TKO. Escobedo's corner called the fight. Did you think that was the right move by Escobedo's corner to call the fight? He had taken some damage,
but
he wasn't busted up.
And the thing about it is, there's two things you realize. You know you don't have to worry about this kid again coming down to fight you. You're coming down to control it this way. There's still fights to be made. You still got the cloud that of the weight issue. So you can say that was an unfair advantage. So you still have the opportunity to make noise at this weight, and you got the money. You know, they renegotiate because he's about to walk away. You got the money you want, so you walk away with the purse. You know, and you can still reposition yourself. And he was a game fighter. He gave it all he can. He showed a lot of heart. A lot of people were, really kind of understanding his pain he was going through. He got the daughter that he just had. He got the storyline. So, he has a great corner person that got, knowing when to quit, because this isn't about – this kid is leaving the division. So it's about, reestablishing yourself there. So I thought it was a smart – stop. Sometimes you got to just protect your fighter when you got a sense that this is not going to go in the right direction.
Yeah. PhD, did you have a chance to check the Broner fight?
No, I did not.
Okay. Have you had an opportunity to see anything or hear anything about this guy? Because Twitter blew up when this cat after the fight. There were comments on Twitter about how he did and how the fight went. What'd you think? Have you heard anything about him?
Yeah, I mean, this guy's middle name is Charisma. He's a real interesting guy. I actually had a chance to talk to Doug Fisher about him offline a little bit. And Doug seems to think he's the real deal. Obviously, Doug's a lot closer to the situation than we are. But from a semi-boxing fan, he's really interesting. And, he and Canelo Alvarez are two guys that I can see taking boxing into the next century.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. I think those two guys are definitely the future of the sport right now. Some guys like Amir Khan are hanging around in that conversation as well. Donaire is hanging in that conversation. There's some young boxers who are coming up, as Floyd and Manny begin to kind of enter into the latter stages of their careers. Some of these younger guys are stepping up, and they're going to be taking those torches and running with them. So I just wanted to touch base. The kid is going to be something that we're going to be talking about for quite some time. So for those of you who haven't been introduced to him, you don't know who he is, just know you heard about him here first with the Real Sports Guys.
What I want to say is he does kind of up his game when it comes to which rapper brings him in. Floyd comes in with 50. You can't come in with Waka Flocka.
Waka Flocka Flame. Come on, man.
You better off wrapping yourself in like you did the time before. I thought he should have brought himself in like he did the fight before when he wrapped in rather than Rock. Rock is not a whatever. He's not a lyricist.
Yeah, you gotta get, if you're going to get a young cat, man, you got to get yourself a Kendrick Lamar, a Big Crit, you know, a Currency, you know what I mean? You know, even if you go try to find a cat from the Midwest to rep with you, you could do that, man. Get yourself a J. Cole or somebody like that to come in the ring with you. But you can't just roll in there with no Waka. Come on now. I agree on that assessment, D. Wills. You're listening to the Real Sports Guys, realsportsguys.com, Renegade Radio, RSG. Now we're going to talk a little baseball as we begin to wind down the show. We're in the second half of the Major League season. You know, we're going into the All-Star break. Teams are beginning to retool, reassess, figure out where they are as they begin to make their pennant chase. Trade deadline is quickly approaching at the end of this month. Some big moves have happened today. To talk about one of those big moves, I'm going to throw it to our resident Yankee fan, PhD. You guys acquired Ichiro Suzuki. Is this a big deal? Good move, bad move? How do you feel about this?
I like the move. I mean, no huge surprise there. I like the move. I think Ichiro's got a lot left in the tank. And you know, one of the things that is concerning is that the Yankees have seemed kind of acquired and collected this stable of over the hill talent, and that is concerning. Got A-Rod towards the back end, Ichiro, think about Abreu a couple years ago. You think about Sheffield. All these guys had decent years, but they only could give you a couple of years. Even Teixeira. Yeah. So right now they have going into play today, they had a 6-game lead. So it's a pretty safe bet that the playoffs likely win the division unless something dramatically changes, which is possible. The key thing for me with the Yankees is that Rivera. Psychologically or not, the numbers don't lie. And when they got into the eighth inning, when they got through 7 full innings and they had a lead, pretty much the game was over, you know, 99 times out of 100. And Soriano, he's been decent, you know, hanging out with the Inside the Park, check him out, Wednesday, 8:30 Central. Hanging out with the host RJ Page a couple of days ago, we were talking some baseball, and of course he's very happy that his Tigers are playing better, and you know, as a Yankee fan, the Tigers concern me because you look at what happened last year with their pitching, and the Tigers just had nothing for them. So I'm also interested in seeing what the Pirates do. I've really been pulling for them. They've made it through the All-Star break. They're still in contention. And I'd love to see the Pirates and the Nationals, you know, in the playoffs. Baseball is a sport where you can see teams really have poor seasons for a stretch of time. But it's so cool to see them actually break through, especially smaller market teams, and have the success that Pittsburgh's been enjoying.
Now, D. Wills, why don't you check in with the people and give them some more storylines that you're looking for, you're looking forward to following in the second half of the season as we as teams begin to make that push towards clinching divisions and winning pennants.
Well, I think Phil touched on a little bit for me is Pittsburgh, and given that they were just you got to talk about this was a franchise. You know, I grew up definitely as a Tigers fan, but I always had this, you know, I was a Steeler fan and the Pittsburgh Pirates and, you know, We Are Family, Willie Stargell, all the way up through Bobby Bonilla and Bonds and Van Slyke. And you know, this is a proud baseball town, and they had this beautiful stadium. One of my colleagues just came back. He's trying to visit all the stadiums, but he just went to Pittsburgh and just talked about how beautiful the stadium is. This is a team I'm looking to watch. And part of it is, you know, they got a great player in McCutchen, but the second half of their season, they're playing, I think they load up on the Cubs. They play Houston. So their schedule allows them to be aggressive down the stretch and to be successful. So the Pirates, and then Phil was talking about Washington. I think everybody's talking about Strasburg. What are they going to do with the inning count and whether or not that's the right way to go? I mean, baseball kills me with these pitching counts. I mean, I grew up at a time where guys pitch serious innings. And I remember Atlanta, when they those heavyweights, I mean, they believed in working their guys and throwing them in between starts. And so this philosophy around inning counts as though it's going to make a difference, you know, it's going to be interesting how they handle that down the stretch. I mean, they've been pretty straight about holding to that, but whether or not they're going to milk some innings by resting him in between, you know, maybe, you know, how they might control his starts, whatever they might be. But if they get to the playoffs, they got a chance. They got a talented team. They got a chance to make some noise. So I think those two moves, the Dodgers were struggling early on, but they seem to, you know, be getting some things back together a little bit. And you know, with the move with, you know, Magic and what they're trying to inject in there. But, you know, I really think Pittsburgh is the story. And I think Washington, I mean, I think they're just given a lot of traditional powers. When you see like Philadelphia struggling, I mean, those are two teams that, for me, make a lot of sense.
Yeah, Pittsburgh, watching them, you know, watching the Nationals, those are going to be some of the stories that I follow. One story I'm going to be following is the AL Central race. My White Sox are involved. I know you guys are Michigan heads, so you guys may be pulling for the Tigers. You know, the White Sox are hanging right in there. I'd love to see them get into the playoffs again. You know, it's been a minute. We had the World Series in 05, but they've been kind of quiet the last couple of years. They'll make a run every now and then, but they haven't been in it the way they, you know, they haven't been in it consistently. That race is really shaping up, though. When you have Cleveland at 3 games back, the Sox at half game back, and Detroit coming on like gangbusters right now, which you talked about them scaring you and your Yankees, Phil. They didn't jump on my White Sox. So I'm really worried about the Tigers finally waking up and getting their act together. I'm hoping we can keep pace. I don't know if the White Sox have enough pitching. Hopefully the bats can carry us for a little bit. Dunn has finally awakened from his 7-year slump. this cat's been pretty terrible in his time with the White Sox. But this year he's back, hit for power. He's hitting the ball well. So that's going to be a race that I follow closely. Another situation that I'm going to be following is the wild card races. You know, that's a new element this year with the additional wild card. Seeing how, you know, some of those teams like Oakland and Cleveland and Los Angeles and the LA Angels and Tampa and Baltimore, some of those teams that may not be in contention for their own division at this particular point. There's still a lot of time left and a lot of things can happen. But there's going to be quite a few teams, especially when you have almost the entire AL East within striking distance of, you know, one of those wild card spots. So you have a whole division who's in the mix. Plus you have, you know, two teams from the Central, two or three teams from the AL West who are all going to be in the mix as we head down the stretch for one of those wild card spots. I think that wild card is going to add a different element. You're going to get more markets engaged, more markets involved as the season winds down, which is good for baseball, good for the excitement around the game. So that's one thing I'm looking forward to. Who do you have? You guys follow baseball way more closely than I do. Who do you have as favorites going down the stretch, PhD? Who do you got as your two teams that you think are going to, well, once the melee starts, the melee we call the playoffs, once that all starts and the dust settles, these two teams are going to be left standing. They're going to face off in a World Series.
I hate to say this, but I'm going to go with the Rangers. It's really tough. You know, my reaction is going to Yankees. because I'm a Yankee fan, but the Rangers are just dangerous. They're pitching, they're hitting everything. So that's what I like in the American League. You know, I will be fiercely cheering for the Yankees, but I think this is the year that Uncle Ron brings it home, Ron Washington.
Where's the bottle? Always say hide the ripple.
Hide the ripple. He's going to be in there with the sham piffle. He's going to be in there with the sham piffle. Champagne and ripple. Sham piffle.
You know, I've never had ripple. I've never had a sip of ripple. I don't know if I'm old enough yet. Is there an age limit?
There's an age limit on ripple, bro.
Yeah, it's like 35 and up night at the club, man. There's a certain threshold you got to be at to really truly enjoy this and be able to truly savor this particular product. And that one of them is ripple.
Yeah. Kind of got to grow into that one, man.
Yeah, you do. You got to grow into that one, man. Yeah. You definitely got to grow into that one. It's like it's like a button up, man. You got to graduate to that. I'm not there yet. Well, man, D. Will, what about you? Going into the as we begin to look forward, put on your Negro Diamonds turban, and who do you see playing in the World Series?
I agree, Uncle Ron. It's kind of like, you know, the Rangers going through it kind of like basketball, you know, kind of like the Pistons had to go to rites of passage. You know what I'm saying? The Bulls had to go to rites of passage.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to get there and lose. And I think they're ready to win. So I think they're going to come. It's going to be real competitive coming out of there, but I just think they've been in enough of these games over the past few years. I think they're ready to win it. The NL is the most interesting because they could go anywhere. I think the Giants, offensively, you know, they got, what is it, Milky Cabrera. They got Posey. They got a little bit of, but I think, you know, what you hope is that they're pitching and some of the stuff begins to come around. They got some injuries, but I just feel like something about, I mean, they're hanging around at the top on the West, you know, with the Dodgers. I think the Giants may figure out how to get it right, and they've been there recently. They might get there, but I just think that then the Rangers are just going to overpower them. I think Washington is great, but I think part of it is they're young guns. You know, they're new, they're on the block, and you almost have to learn how to win. And so, you know, I think they have an opportunity. But I think the Giants, you know, I'm not the biggest baseballer, but I just feel like the Giants in the open, at the end of the day, pitching's come around. Some of their best pitchers have been, you know, they've had some struggles this year, but they're hanging at the top. And all you need to do is put a couple weeks together, and you can get it done. A lot of these teams who are at the top haven't had a lot of experience winning. I mean, the only other team that, you know, a lot of them are in striking distance. But, you know, the usuals like Philadelphia, they're at the bottom. The Mets kind of in the middle, on the fringe. You know, you got Cincinnati, Pittsburgh. And these are teams, but they haven't been in the moment. They got some leadership, managers. You got some folks who've been there, but the players haven't been there. And I think the team with the most experience nibbling on the top is San Francisco.
All right. So we're gonna document those for the moment. I'm not going to hold you to them because those are impromptu. You know, there was no prep involved in that. That's just shake-up reaction, and I want to get that out there. So we'll document that. You know, that, you made that off based on the information you got today. That'll change. The baseball season is a marathon. It's not a sprint. So, you know, as we get closer and closer to the playoffs and things actually beginning to shape up as they will finish, then we'll check back in and see if you guys are still feeling the same way about those particular teams. Real quick, we have a little bit of time before we get into the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. August 7th, premiere, HBO Hard Knocks with the Miami Dolphins. Hard Knocks is a show that I love to watch. It takes you behind the scenes of an NFL training camp, an uncensored look at what goes on. You get to see kind of guys behind the scenes, everybody from the starting quarterback, the start defensive end, to, you know, the seventh round undrafted fullback who's trying to make the roster, the long snapper is trying to make the roster. Are you guys excited about watching the Dolphins? D. Will, are you excited about watching the Dolphins on Hard Knocks?
Child, please.
You know, he changed his name back to Johnson.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Goodness. You know, he's trying to. Hey, the lady, she's not going with Ocho Cinco. She's not going with that.
Cinco is the last name.
Yeah, she's like, we got to get this right before we go to the altar. But, you know, Chad alone is going to be entertaining. You know, must see TV. I'm interested. You know, last year I got killed in the draft. Game Changer was there when I went Reggie Bush and Reggie fed me down the stretch. Reggie delivered like I thought he would. I got him on the way. He was like, stock getting the way up, y'all. Get up. We got some blue stock. Reggie got him on the way up. And because what I realized, they weren't using him correctly. But I think they got a coach that understands how to use him. And I just think they're doing it. Their defense was scrappy down the stretch. You know, so I got a great – they got a great storyline down the stretch. So, you know, it's Miami, man. You know, being around Florida. So I think it's going to be a good stuff. And I think having Chad on there is going to add a new element. He's used to being around that. He's probably prepping the guys on what it's like and how important it is. So I think it's going to be good. And it is good to get a team that's on the way up trying to learn how to win. You know, we've had some high-profile folks who are kind of on the verge. It's good to have a team that is – you know, I don't know if they bottom up, but they're kind of coming back up. You know, you don't know where they're going to end and kind of get a sense of how they prepare.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the storylines I'm really interested in really checking out is, you know, they have some stars and guys like Reggie Bush and Chad Ochocinco and Chad Johnson. Another guy who's kind of an under-the-radar guy who I think is going to become a star after the show is Vontae Davis. He's a cornerback from the University of Illinois. He's Vernon Davis' younger brother. He plays corner. We all know corners like to talk in general. You have to have a special mentality to be a cornerback because, you know, that's an individual. You fight individual battles all day in the team sport. And most of the time you lose. You know, most of the time you're going to lose because that's just the way it goes. You're chasing around the fastest dudes on the field, and you have no clue where – you have a clue. At that level, you have a clue. But, you know, for the most part, you're trying to figure out where they're going before they get there. It's a real hard job. But they have a lot of confidence. In order to do the job effectively, you got to have a ton of confidence. So these dudes are usually talkers. So I think Vontae Davis is going to be a guy who comes out of this as somebody who becomes a star from this situation. PhD, what do you think about the venue, Miami? You know, you got the basketball wives in Miami. You know, you got the heat in Miami. Miami's a hot spot. You got Ozzy down there. Miami's the place to be. Do you think this was a good choice for HBO?
Yeah, I don't think you can go wrong when you've got hardcore football fans who, you know, are just kind of sitting there. It's been a long time. You shouldn't have left me. You know, and you're hungry.
Yes, sir.
You're hungry for football. I don't think you can go wrong when you have any NFL team. So I'm going to watch. I have never watched an episode of Hard Knocks where I've been disappointed. You know, some are certainly better than others, but when you get that behind the scene all access, man, there's nothing that compares. So I don't care if it's Miami, I don't care if it's Buffalo, it's football, man, and we all geared up to see it. So I'm gonna be tuning in.
Yeah, training camps open this week, man. I've got about 3 mock fantasy drafts under my belt already. I'm working to lather up. You know, in a couple of weeks, we're going to see if we can get Ray to come back and join us and get us primed for fantasy football. We're going to do a fantasy football special. D. Wills, CEO, you know, Suge Wills is working that out as we speak. You know, we put Suge on that. He's working out the kinks, getting the details in order, getting the contracts already. We're going to get that going. He's going to engineer that for us. You know, speaking of moments, you know, on Hard Knocks, one of my favorite moments on Hard Knocks was when the Jets was on there and Revis was in a contract dispute. And they had the magician come in. And, you know, the magician is doing tricks. And one of the players, one of the Jets players in the crowd, you know, hey, can you make Revis appear? There was that moment. And then there was the most infamous moment ever, I mean, in my opinion, in Hard Knocks.
Cromartie.
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 I rewound that on my DVR when it happened. I watched it live, and I rewound it because I was like, nah, that brother didn't just do that on TV, man. So I'm sure there's going to be some great moments with this year's Hard Knocks. I do think it's going to present a bit of a challenge because you got a new coach coming in, and he's going to be trying to do new things and different things, and he's going to have to learn how to do that with all of that other attention. And, you know, most of the guys, they after a day or two, you forget about it. Those are guys who have been there before and have done this whole training camp thing as the head coach. So it'll be interesting to see how Joe Philbin handles that particular situation. So that's Hard Knocks, premiering August 7th. As you can tell, we're itching for some football. Can't wait. It's coming. It'll be here soon. A couple weeks, we'll get the Hall of Fame game, and it'll be rolling.
Can't wait.
So there we go. That's what I'm talking about. Get that Bart Scott going. So we're going to keep the show rolling and pay a few bills. Now we're going to get into our Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So what did the real sports guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today. Yes, Resistance Digital. That's where we those are our go-to guys. That's where we hit up LR for all of our electronic needs. I'm finna talk to him about getting me the spaceship. You know, I'm gonna get a spaceship next week. You know, take a trip. You know, I ain't went on vacation yet. I've been thinking about places to go. I thought Saturn looked nice for night, so I'm gonna try that. LR, I need that spaceship. I need that. But another thing we need, D Wills.
We need more dogs.
My dog of the week is Dr. Bart Emmert, the biggest dog. I thought nobody had a bigger dog in him than Goodell, and he has exceeded the Goodell. We have a new term, the Emmert. He went Emmert on him, and that's my dog of the week.
All right. All right. Yeah, he earned it, man. He took a bite out of crime, I guess. I guess you could say he took a bite out of crime. My man, PhD.
We need more dogs.
Tiger Woods, top five in the major. Let's be happy and okay with that.
There you go. Just take what you can get, all right? Cat can't win every time. He kind of spoiled us a little bit. You got to understand, brother can't win every single time.
We need more dogs.
Yet and still we do. So for my dog of the week, I'm going to golf, and I'm going Ernie Els. You know, we talked about Adam Scott, and we kind of called it a bit of a choke, but I think just as much as it was a choke, Ernie Els kind of took that from him a little bit. You know, he kind of punked him and snatched his milk off his tray. You know, Adam thought he had it wrapped up. Ernie said, "Nah, son, I got this," and he kind of knocked his tray over, spilled milk on his coat, and you know, told him to go home to mama. So that's the Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Again, Resistance Digital, check them out for all your digital solutions. Very economical. Holler at our boy LR if you need anything electronic. Get at him. Now, we want to preview shows that we have coming up. I'm going to pass that to my man, PhD. Run with it, my man.
Now, live listeners, we're going to be moving over to the after hours here in a couple of seconds. But first of all, I want to let you all know that we have a special USA basketball, men's basketball preview that's going to be featuring the Game Changer and also Justin Page. Same two cats that got together to do this really nice NBA draft preview. This is going to air tomorrow night, 10 o'clock Central. Be sure to check for it come Thursday morning on your podcast. It's going to be epic. It's going to be fun. And I think you're really going to enjoy us previewing Team USA and their upcoming Olympic opponents. want to thank Doug Fisher for coming on with us last week. We had a great time with Doug Fisher, the editor of Ring TV. And then in coming weeks, Justin Page will be coming on next week, as well as Eric Hamilton, to do whole shows with us. So that's what we got coming up, and that's what we got going.
All right, all right. So that's our show for this week. Thank you for listening to The Real Sports Guys. Check us out at realsportsguys.com, RSG Renegade Radio. Hit us up on Twitter and Facebook. Take care. Be blessed. We'll see you next week. Peace.